16-2019. The time is 8:35, and this is the meeting of the Complaint Screening Committee of the State of Arizona Board of Psychologist Examiners. Roll call, please, Ms. Broadus.
Yes, Mr. Donaldson?
Present.
Dr. Brundage? Dr. Flower?
Present.
We have a quorum.
Thank you. The Complaint Screening Committee, pursuant to ARS 32-20818, may dismiss the complaints occurring on this agenda or refer them to the full board for consideration and action. Complaints dismissed by the committee shall not be disclosed in response to a telephone inquiry or placed on the board's website pursuant to ARS 32-20811H1. Upon a vote of the majority of the quorum, he may go into executive session on any item on the agenda pursuant to ARS 38-431.03A2. To review confidential records or aid to receive confidential legal advice from the board's attorney. For those in attendance, please be aware that the chair reserves the right to change the order of the items on the agenda based upon the parties present and request to speak. A person or a representative of a person who has filed or received a complaint and who is present may make a brief statement to the committee by filling out a request to speak form and giving it to a board staff person. The committee may also have questions for those who speak. Please use only initials for patients and children. Be aware that the content of many records involved in these complaints is confidential, and the content should not be discussed in a public meeting. Be advised that the committee will go into executive session to discuss any confidential records. The first complaint to be discussed today is number 18-22, Sandra Graff, ED. Dr. Flowers, you are the lead committee member for this complaint. Would you please provide the committee an overview of the complaint?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. The complainant is JN. JN alleges that Dr. Graff was biased and acted unprofessionally due to inappropriately recommending that JN undergo DBT counseling, not going over the evaluation with her and making inaccurate statements in the report. JN said that Dr. Graff was very cruel in her opinion of her, provided a biased report, and discriminated against her because of her Native American heritage. JN said that the Department of Child Safety case was prolonged because of Dr. Graff's evaluation. JN said that she lost custody of her oldest child because of Dr. Graff. Dr. Graff's complaint response was submitted through her attorney, Larry Cohen. Basically, it states that Dr. Graff has been conducting psychological evaluations for 30 years. For 12 of those years, she's been conducting evaluations for the Department of Child Safety, DCS. Her cases at DCS involve DCS acquiring temporary custody of a child or severance of parental rights. The work for DCS involves practicing within parameters to meet the expectations and requirements of DCS. Dr. Graff said that the referral for JN was court-ordered, but that she never received any documentation from the court appointing her to conduct the evaluation. So she conducted the evaluation under the direction of DCS. Dr. Graff was never asked to testify in court or to provide any court services. Dr. Graff did not provide any custody recommendations. Dr. Graff states that in 2015, the referral was from the case manager by the name of Savannah Hopp. Key referral questions were to determine if JN had a mental disorder, and if so, how it would affect her parenting skills. She was asked to provide a prognosis and whether mental health or counseling services would be helpful and what services would be recommended. She was also asked to comment on the parent-child relationship and any risks to the child. The referral for the 2016 evaluation had the same questions. Dr. Graff did not provide clinical care to JN. She was not required to review the 2015 and 2016 reports with JN, but did so when DCS approved the request. Dr. Graff said that she made changes to the 2016 report when JN provided details regarding her past. Dr. Graf stated that the changes did not affect the outcome of the evaluation or the recommendations. She denied being biased or being discriminatory in her services for JN. This concludes my summary of the case.
Thank you, Dr. Flowers. Will the licensee please come forward to speak?
Chairman Donaldson, committee members, my name is Larry Cohen. I represent Dr. Graf, who's sitting to my left. I'm going to make a brief opening statement, and then Dr. Graf will be available to answer any questions that members of the committee may have. As I reflected back on this case and looked at the issues that have been raised by JN, both as individual issues and as general issues, the conclusion I've come to is this. JN believes that Dr. Graf's analysis was result-driven, meaning that Dr. Graf had some kind of agenda that she was pursuing that resulted in the outcomes that to which JN objects. That simply wasn't what was going on. Dr. Graf's work was entirely evidence-driven, relying upon the information provided to her by DCS, which she obtained during her interviews with JN, and the testing that she did. And we've spent a great deal of time in our response trying to go through and address each of the issues that JN raised, as well as identifying all of the ways in which Dr. Graf set out to and then did proceed in conducting a competent, professionally appropriate, and within the bounds of ethics and standards evaluation of what took place here. There just isn't time, Chairman Donaldson, members of the committee, to go through each of the items that were raised. Anticipating that, we wrote that very lengthy response and tried to address each of them as we went along. It's important for the committee to be clear about a few things. Dr. Graf was working as a forensic psychologist in this case, not as a treating psychologist. She was not providing clinical care. Her work with JN was not intended to be therapeutic work. It was intended to be forensic work that would provide DCS with the information it wanted. And the information that DCS wanted essentially comes down to this. They had a situation where a child had been severely injured in JN's household, and DCS had concerns about JN's appreciation of the ways in which she as a parent may not be providing appropriate protection. They were concerned whether those issues were incidental or they were more fundamental, that is to say, based in her character, her personality, her ability to understand, things of that sort. That's what they asked Dr. Graf to address. She addressed it once in the 2015 evaluation, provided a report, and then was asked again in 2016, not at her behest. That was not her suggestion to draw the report. It was DCS's request that she come back and do that. Before doing the 2016 report, or in the course of doing it, JN identified some concerns she had about the some of the history content in the 2015 report, and Dr. Graf was given permission by DCS to go over that with her. The issues were not mistakes that Dr. Graf made. They were changes that JN made in the content of what she provided. Dr. Graf appropriately did not change her 2015 report, but incorporated that into the 2016 report. My point is only that even though this was a forensic process, Dr. Graf, within the bounds of what she was permitted to do with DCS as her client, tried to be respectful of and attentive to JN throughout this process. The issues, the second issue I would make is that this is a family law, this is not a family law custodial case in which the parties hire experts and the experts may or may not do one thing or another. This was a case in which Dr. Graf was hired by DCS to provide it with information. DCS then used that information, not just from Dr. Graf, but from a variety of different sources. So when JN talks about how the DCS process went and the length of time and decisions that were made, those were not decisions made by Dr. Graf. She had a limited role and provided information in the context of that role. We know that DCS consulted with other professionals. We know that DCS was engaged in interacting with treating providers. We know that DCS was deliberative, even to the extent of asking for the second evaluation. But again, Dr. Graf's role was limited to doing the evaluations that she did. Finally, there were no court proceedings in which Dr. Graf was involved She was aware that this was court-ordered, but she never had any interaction with the court. She would not have to testify. She was not told that a report would be used in a court proceeding. With respect to those reports, she was not even involved in the decision for for JN to see them. That was a DCS decision. Dr. Graff's reports were written in an appropriate professional manner, something that a layperson understandably would not be able to appreciate. One of the comments we made at the end of our response was that it's unfortunate the way this process works. It doesn't provide for the evaluator to have any interactions with the person being evaluated in terms of going over the report, but again, it's a forensic setting and it doesn't provide for that. Hopefully down the road, DCS will do more of that. They could use other psychologists who are retained by them to do that, or they could even ask someone like Dr. Graff, the evaluator. But presently, it doesn't provide for that. So it does lead a distance, and one would argue in a forensic setting, an appropriate distance between the evaluator and the person being evaluated. Dr. Graff, as we tried to demonstrate in our response, works very hard to stay up with the literature. Came through, I hope, in the discussion about DBT and the literature that Dr. Graff relied upon for making her recommendation. And again, I need to emphasize it's a recommendation to DCS in response to their question. She was not involved in delivering care. She was not involved in treating and selecting providers. She simply did the work that DCS requested, and based upon the literature and her prior work and providing evaluations, made a DBT recommendation. Dr. Graff does the very same thing with her work with understanding the instruments that she uses. She attends all appropriate CE during the year to maintain that level of competence. Again, her role is that of a neutral provider, and she's very much stayed within that role in this case. Again, I could go on at great length about all the details, but we tried very hard to provide that to the committee already. Dr. Graff is here and ready to answer any questions that the committee may have. Thank you, Chairman Donaldson, members of the committee.
Thank you. Dr. Graff, do you have any comments to make?
I think just to clarify my role, I think that I was a DCS was concerned about this an injury that occurred to this child in the home of JN. She wasn't there, but she had been living with her boyfriend who was the perpetrator. The child admitted to this perpetration, but she had been living with him for 7 years and had two children by him. And yet, within this context, DCS was concerned that this occurred in the home. So she requested a critical evaluation of the psychological status of JN as it pertains to parenting potential in order to discover what exactly happened and how DCS might provide services as to correct parenting issues, psychological issues in JN that may have caused her not to see the forest through the trees and allow this to happen in the home so the child would be safe. These evaluations are focused on the safety and well-being of the children. It's a critical evaluation of the parent to ascertain to make sure the safety of the child is protected.
Thank you.
Thank you again, Chairman Donaldson. Again, if there are any questions, Dr. Graff would be happy to answer them.
Dr. Flowers, do you have any questions?
Yes, I have some. And to some degree, I think that they have been addressed. But just by clarification and for elaboration here, I'm wondering, do you have a contract with DCS that describes your role and responsibilities for these kind of cases?
Yes, I do. I have a contract with DCS. And in our response to the complaint, the role that I am, it's a very strict role and is written into the complaint that I have to follow these strict parameters. They expect me to use certain instruments, to provide certain information in the reports. And then the question is for me to provide any recommendations, mental health recommendations, to ameliorate any problems that are discovered in the parent that could be possibly fixed so that she can go on. But this, yes, in very strict rules.
Dr. Flowers, on pages 1 and 2 of our response, we quoted some of the areas from the scope of work that are involved. I'm sure you've reviewed that.
I did.
If you're seeking a copy of the contract, we'd be happy to provide it.
Okay. Oh, no, I just, it sounds like, you know, obviously you need to go by whatever the rules are, especially with DCS and so forth. But, yeah, so apparently there is a contract, and I guess there are times it may or may not describe responsibilities, or it may, within the contract, to say, we're going to hire you and you'll do according to our policies or something. But I guess, obviously, within all of that, she was aware of what they expected. And from what I understand, I guess I can ask, has DCS made any complaints regarding this evaluation or the two evaluations?
Dr. Flower, we're not aware of any complaints that have been made either informally to Dr. Graff by the caseworker or by anyone else.
Okay. Who knows, something happened, but if she's not aware, then that's all she would, of course, need to know. And from what I gather, I would imagine that DCS was the individual or the organization paying for the service.
That's correct.
Is that correct as well?
Yes.
And they are the custodians of the records?
That's correct. They own the record.
Okay. And I guess with all this, I'm just wondering, it was court ordered, but from what I understand, you never received the court order?
Yeah, let me explain how that works, if I could, please, Dr. Flowers. In order for DCS to become involved as it does, at some point the court has to be consulted and notified that this process is going on. So Dr. Graff's involvement is court-ordered to the extent that there are standing orders that provide for DCS to do various kinds of work, to include having a psychologist do the evaluation. But Dr. Graff never received anything from the court. In custody cases in family court, for example, you might see a minute entry order that says psychologist X will do Y, and sometimes you see that in the juvenile court proceedings. So far as we know, that is to say Dr. Graff's know, this case never proceeded in the court or beyond the establishment of the case. If something did take place, she's not aware of it, but we don't have any minute entry orders, other kinds of orders that dealt with that.
I'll add to that.
So
the process is that DCS is ordered by the court, and I never saw the minute entry, but there usually is a minute entry that says you shall obtain a psychological evaluation. And then from that, DCS contacts a provider. But it is, they order DCS, not the psychologist directly.
Okay, so it sounds as if your name specifically was not in the order. But they were told, DCS said they need to get it done. And since you're a contract with them, you're one of those that, you were chosen. Okay. And then, from what I understand, too, I've had these as questions, but I can just put them out as I understand it, then maybe you can comment. From what I understand, DCS is responsible for deciding child custody issues, I guess, in conjunction with the court. And is that correct?
That's correct.
Okay, you didn't say who needs to go where. You just would give observations regarding your findings.
That's correct.
As far as determining specific services and interventions for the case, that also is what DCS decides. You recommended things, but you didn't necessarily determine that they were mandated.
That's correct.
Let me be even stronger, okay. Dr. Flowers, if I could, please.
Okay.
The scope of work in her contract provides for her, when requested, to make recommendations for how DCS may proceed in addressing the issues she's identified in her evaluation. And so she makes a recommendation, but she had no involvement whatsoever in deciding whether to proceed with that recommendation or some other, to choose the people who did the treatment, and then to review the treatment record to decide whether what had been done was consistent with her recommendation. She simply makes the recommendation and is not even consulted, much less involved in the process thereafter.
That's right.
Okay. Okay. Thank you. I put down, I wanted to know how you decided what to do, but you've already answered that as far as reviewing available information, testing information, and your actual interview with the client. So that's been answered. Thank you.
Is JN here? Okay, would you fill out one of these forms and give it to the staff, please? It's been my experience on this board for many years. It's hard for someone becomes a subject of DCS. It's hard for that person to understand the relationship between the psychologist and DCS. It's like the relationship between military and people.
That's right, Mr. Donaldson. I completely agree with you.
It's very difficult.
It's very difficult.
It's really different.
I'd like us to step back, Mr. Donaldson.
Please. Mm-hmm. Thank you. And please use only your initials. Initials?
JN.
Go ahead and speak.
The evaluation that I was given, yes, it was from the Department of Child Safety. I just want to start by saying that case has been closed and was unfounded. I have full custody of my kids, two of my kids from the case, and currently fighting for custody for my oldest son, who was also in the case. The evaluation played a huge part on how everything ended for me as far as my oldest son, who was who I lost custody of. The evaluation that was given had some fraudulent information in there that I was extremely upset by. One being the worst, I guess you say, out of the others was that it was put in here that I was molested by three relatives, just different relatives in my parents' home, which never happened. I don't even know where she got that from. I don't know where it even came from. And that led to supposedly suffering from that trauma. I had to get, I was unable to mother my children. I was unable to, well, let me just go to the last page where the recommendation is, where it was like, I had to read this over and over just to get a grasp as to, I couldn't believe what was written. But basically the results that that she put on here was that I developed unconscious maladaptive patterns to defend against unresolved traumas that I experienced in the past. I'm still trying to figure out what trauma she's talking about, and I'm assuming it's that, which was not even true. And on there, she even said that I didn't tell my parents because it was in our Navajo culture. It's not in the Navajo culture to disclose that to begin with. So to even put that, I don't know where she got that as well. And I'm just really was upset by it. This evaluation caused my case to go ongoing for 18 months. I saw two different other counselors, I guess, that were gonna assess me to get this DBT treatment. And both counselors would not counsel me because they said I didn't meet the criteria. I don't know how they do their assessment or how they determine that, but in the end they refused it until they found a third counselor who was told not to assess me, but was told she was just contracted to give me that. So that's where I learned more about my evaluation. She went over it with me, and when she got my evaluation, interviewed me, and spent some time with me, she said she had to ask herself, is this the right person? Because I don't see how the two are, she's like, this evaluation doesn't match anything, like, as I'm sitting here with you. And, but she was like, well, I am contracted to give you this, so the DBT treatment. So I started it. I went through group counseling with several people, and to hear their trauma was extremely, it was very, how can I say, I felt like, I don't know why I'm in this room, compared to how the stories that were shared were very, would cause trauma to somebody, just put it that way. And as for me, I think the only thing, I didn't know what to share, except that, well, I haven't seen my kids in like 4 months, and that's trauma, you know, and that's due to the report that they removed my kids from me. And this report also was used against me in my custody case. And the part where I can't even grasp is where she said, where she put that I had no bond with my children. I'm very close with my children. I don't even know where that came from or how. My disordered personality traits have negatively impacted my ability to effectively engage in interpersonal relationships. I don't understand that's not even the kind of person that I am. I'm an extremely, I guess how I would describe myself is I have a lot of family support. I may not have a lot of friends, but I have like two very good close friends, lifelong friends. I don't know I was just trying to determine how this defined me. But yet it's written right here. And this is what prolonged my case. And due to that is how I lost custody of my son. While I was trying to fight this in the DCS case, after a while, the new case manager even thought like I should get my case closed. It prolonged it, and that's within that time frame is when they gave custody of my son to a father he doesn't even know, never known, had no relationship with. And that now is gone into, and now like he got a hold of this, and not only does he. I guess you could say when some like this falls into the wrong hands, which was his hands, he now like waves it in my face, like, oh, you're stupid, look at you. And it's just hard to deal with because it's written. So that's why I made the complaint, because I feel like I suffered a lot because of this evaluation. It did a lot to me, especially that there's fraudulent information in there. I don't understand how someone could just write something, submit it, and then now I'm being treated for something that was just written that is untrue. And it did a lot of damage emotionally, and it did a lot of damage to me. And now, because of it, I'm having to fight for my son's to get my son home, my oldest son home. And it's been hard. It's an emotional, it's very emotional, it's very mentally draining. So that's why I made this complaint. Along with other things that were written about me. I had to go over it several times with this counselor as to what does this mean, given my low average intellectual prowess. It's likely that I'm over-challenged by jobs requiring a bachelor's and master's degree. Well, I do hold a job. It's actually a career that I have. Yeah, it does require a bachelor's, and I'm doing very well in it. It helps me to provide for my entire family. I have a home because of it. I have a vehicle because of it. I'm now going, I got accepted back in my doctorate program. I don't know what she's talking about. Like, am I unable to do this? Is what it sounds like. Basically, she's putting there that I need to be assisted in recognizing my strengths and weaknesses as they apply to the world of the work. I require guidance in obtaining more realistic job to allow me to be financially stable and thereby able to focus on my children. My children are everything, and that is why I'm doing this. I don't understand how it got turned around to where the focus is on me getting, I guess, and I forgot my children. I just don't know how she got that. It's just, other things that were written. I'm just, it hurts just to even read this. Focus on painful, okay, again, it affects me, my mothering. I don't understand how, I'm very close with my kids, and especially my son. So I'm just trying to get a grasp on this even now as I read it. It's not valid. It's not true. How can I sit with someone for 15 minutes probably talking and then answering questions, drawing pictures, and this is the result? It doesn't make any sense. And it was used against me over and over, not only in the DCS case, which I'm so glad is over, but also now in my custody case. And now I haven't seen my son in 2 years because of it. I only see him 2 times a month. It hurts, and it's because of this evaluation. So I certainly hope that there's some kind of, I don't know, I hope I'm heard, I guess is all I'm saying. And to close this, I spoke to Dr. DeBacco, who was, I guess he's the one apparently that is the head of this whole, the DCS organization, as far as like who gets evaluations and stuff. I involved him, and in the end, his recommendation was just to join a women's support group, which I am already in, and with my church. I'm in the single mom's ministry, and he said, well, that's it. You just need, you know, support group. And that was his recommendation in the end. And I did show him this and everything, and that's how my case, that's how I was able to go into court, show him them this, the one Dr. DeBacco wrote, and then they could no longer, at least they stayed away from this after that. So that's how everything ended. That's all I want to say. So.
Good, thank you. Dr. Flowers, do you have any questions?
I have a couple, and perhaps you've already addressed them, but I'm wondering what your understanding was of Dr. Graff's role in your situation.
When everything started, I like I said, it's just I've never been in a situation with the system. It was just according to what the first case manager told me, it's just part of the process. All parents will get evaluated. Parents will take parenting classes. Parents will, you know, as long as you provide, go through it, go with the motion, you know, it shouldn't be a problem. That's what I was told. So I kind of just was like, okay, so it's part of the process regardless. And I said both parents, and because the father also was evaluated. Unlike my evaluation, his evaluation was like perfect according to everything, which
okay,
was weird.
It sounds as if it's almost as like a kind of checklist.
Yeah.
As opposed to you were told, this is what Dr. Graff will do, this is what her role is.
Yes.
It wasn't really all that clear.
Yes, it was more like just a checklist, yes. Like that, and that's how she described it, and basically that's kind of how I handled it too. Like, okay, well, so I do this, and this, and I think I had gone finished everything within the first 4 months because I was
okay.
You know.
Okay, when you went with Dr. Graff, do you remember if she went over her role, what she'd be doing, and that kind of thing?
I don't recall.
I
believe when I showed up there, I just assumed like this is something that she does. She works with DCS. This is something that just happens, and now I'm just a part of it. I got to go through it. I've never had an evaluation in my life. Like I just went with it. I just cooperated.
Okay,
that's how you could put it.
Okay, well, there's there are many things psychologists do, and many different roles and possibilities. It doesn't sound as if it was very clear. It's just like this. All these allegations came down, and you were told to cooperate, do all these things, and it'll be good.
Yeah.
Kind of thing. And she was on the checklist, you might say.
Yes.
And now within the report, did she make recommendations regarding child visitation or custody?
No, she didn't make that, but they went based off of a lot of, and I wish I would have brought the court paperwork, a lot of it was just like, based off of that, this is what we feel your visitation should be. So
okay,
it played
they would
like a
make,
small role, but not the role.
They would make conclusions or whatever based on, partially at least on that report.
Yes.
Okay. All right. Those are my only questions.
Chairman Donaldson?
Yes.
I apologize for my... Yes, thank you. Chairman Donaldson, I apologize for the delay. I was under the impression that this meeting occurred later. However, I have been listening to JN and her response. I have several questions, and I think one of the issues I would like is to point committee people to page 83 of 269, which is a summary of recommendations. JN, I know that part of DCS's concern was the several incidents of domestic violence within the home. And I know that at one point within your initial complaint, you said there was one. However, there seems to be multiple issues. And I think that the concern from DCS was whether or not you would be able to protect your family. Can you give me a greater understanding of those issues that affected this decision?
That was actually my question to the last case manager. I said, where are you getting this information from? And if I'm allowed, I can get the emails that I actually sent to her, asking her, where are you getting this information, saying that I was abused repeatedly, or my children and I were being abused in my home. She would never answer my question. She would never, she was like, everything's in the packet. Everything is in the packet that was sent to you. I said, okay, well, and I had the packet, and I said, I have it with me. Can we go over it, and can you please point out where is it? Where in the packet are you getting this from? And she never answered. And then finally I said, did you ever send any emails? I asked her directly if she said ever sent any emails to any of the counselors saying this. I go, because I think that's where they're getting it from. I said, you're lying. Basically, I was calling her out because she was lying. And so then she denied sending an email, but there was another evaluation that Dr. Graff made, and she actually cut and pasted that email in the evaluation. And that's when I confronted that case manager, she threw my case out and gave it to a different case manager. It was, so to say that there was domestic violence in my home, no, that was not true. That's what I was trying to get clarified too. And that's where I'm also making a complaint to DCS, to this case manager. But I do have the emails on hand that was sent. I don't know if I had emailed that to the board to the day I made the complaint, but I have the emails on hand right now.
All right. May I have a further question? I know there was an incident where I believe your son was taken into the hospital, that there had been an injury that he sustained to his leg, and that your significant other had notified you at work. You were not involved in the case immediately, but came home and recognized that he had not sought medical attention. And so you did take him into, I believe, the emergency room. And at that time, the medical staff had indicated that the type of injury sustained would have been something that would have been more intentional. And at one point then, your son disclosed that this person had done that. And I think the kids were removed at that time. Then in records that I'm reviewing, there was a second incident where something happened and the police showed up, and at that time the significant other left with the children, so that there was a concern at that time that the kids were unsafe to be at home.
Okay.
Is that incorrect?
It is very incorrect. I actually met them at the emergency room. I got a call from work. I got a call from him at work. And at the time, I used to do my job was over the phone, working with customers over the phone. And when he had called, I had missed his call. Then he texts like, "I need you," because we only had one vehicle at the time. And he said that it was actually our daughter, not my son. He said that something happened to her hip, and I'm like, well, do you know, like, call your mom, take her to the hospital. I didn't think it was a big thing, and I said, just let me know what happens. I'll meet you guys wherever. That was the end of it, and then the next text was them going, and then I asked to leave early from work, and I met them at the emergency room. And then that's where I guess, like, I just told a story like that, but what they asked for was, like, well, what time was the text message? And I was like, I believe it was, like, at 1:30. I was like, they showed up at, like, 2:45, and I was like, I don't know. I was like, and then it, next thing you know, on the report, it was like, they held back, and they didn't take him right away. Why? And I was like, I don't know. Like, a lot of these, the way I told it and the way it's written is completely just like, it's almost like they were making it to where it looked like we were doing something to the kids. And I was involved, and she's trying to hide it. And really, that was just how I handled it that day. And I was just being honest to them.
Okay. Jan, was there a second incident?
There was not a second incident. What they're talking about is after my daughter was taken out of the hospital, like that same day, it was a Friday, I remember, because it was the weekend, and I was thinking, like, okay, I probably have to take leave from work in order to take care of her. And I was thinking, like, I'll submit my stuff to HR on Monday first thing. And then a detective called me and said, we need to do a forensic interview. Now, my daughter was put in a Spikacast and given medicine, I think it was like morphine, but for children and for the pain. And I told the detective, okay, well, she's in a cast. When I lift her, I can't, I'm unable to take her in. I said, is there a way maybe someone can come out here? We'll close the room. You guys can totally interview her. And he's like, no, we need her here. We need to do this as soon as possible. And so he scheduled it for a Tuesday. And I said, okay, well, maybe she'll be a little better on Tuesday. So Tuesday came around. I went to work, and the father was there with his mother. And I told them, like, the appointment's at 11 o'clock. I said, why don't you just go take her to the appointment? I go, just give her medicine. The thing is, when she took her medicine, it knocked her out. And I just said, you know what? If we have to take her there sleeping for them to see that this is just how it is, maybe they'll get understanding. But when you lifted her, she would cry because she was still in pain. That was my, like, I kept telling the detective that. And then they got on the phone, and they kept saying, like, well, if you don't bring her in, you know your kids are going to get removed. And then I said, do I have to get a lawyer? And I said, because I just feel like you guys are just, you have no consideration for my daughter's pain. You're not trying to listen to me as a mom. Like, I'm asking you guys to come out. I'm doing whatever I can. I guess, like, I was thinking more about my daughter. They were thinking more about, we need to get her in. And that's the part that they don't talk about. And I've constantly brought that up. No one listens to you when you're in court. And that's one thing I discovered. You can have 100% intentions of just trying to do the right thing. Anything you say, they use against you if they twist it and use against you. And that's just what I discovered. They went ahead and they did their investigation, but even with those they interviewed her several times, and one of the stories she did mention, like, her dad did it. And that's when I was like, oh, well, what was the other stories? And in the hospital, when we first got there, I don't know why they don't mention this too, I didn't know what happened because I had just met them there. So when the nurse asked her, you know, what happened, I said, tell her how you got your out. Tell him how you got your out, because it was a male nurse. She said that her brother and her were jumping on her bed. Her brother had a cast too. And this was from him. He sprained it. But we thought it was a sprain, but it was actually the bottom fibula bone right above the ankle had fractured. And so he had a cast. But he was already running around when he had the cast. So her story, what she told the nurse, is we were jumping on the bed in the back, and we collided, and his leg went into me. That was the story she shared with the nurse. And I said, okay, well, I guess that's what happened. And I said, I wasn't there. I'm just meeting them here. And then when they interviewed father, he's like, I wasn't in the room. And he's like, I went in there, and she was on the ground crying, and I picked her up. She screamed. And that's when I called. He said he called me around that time. So that was just how it seemed DCS became involved. 2 o'clock in the morning, they did interviews again. I just cooperated as usual. And then the next thing you know, it led to, well, okay, now you're going to have to supervise him for visits. Or not visits, but just whenever he's around the kids. And I'm like, okay, that's fine. Again, I was just following protocol. Whatever they told me, I said yes to. Whatever they wanted me to sign, I signed. And in the end, when I saw the report, that's when I began. I was like, whoa, this is kind of the way it's written seems like the way it's written and the way it happened is like two completely different stories. You guys are making it look like we're just these horrible parents that are abusing our kids. That's what it looked like. And I felt like that was unfair. But that was City of Phoenix Police that was actually doing that investigation. They closed it, saying they didn't find anything as well. So that was the first thing that we had closed. Then we had to deal with DCS, and then that's later on they brought this up as to prolong my case. It seems like it was no longer about my daughter. I left the father around that time because it was either they're seriously putting it like this, like kids or father. So I said, maybe, I know we've been together a long time, and I said nothing against you. I was like, I'm not losing the kids. And he left, a month after I don't know if it's a reopening of the case in 2016 or whatever, but that's when they removed and tore away. They told me I couldn't be around my kids. That's when I told them to leave. I we've not been together since. That's February of 2016. So I've been doing this on my own, by myself, and even after I left, they stopped using that against me in the DCS case and started using this evaluation as to prolong the case. And it lasted, I think, from 2016, it was finally closed the next year, March of 2017. So that's why it's...
Jan, I have, again, I'm wanting to focus on issues surrounding Dr. Graff's work and Dr.
I'm sorry.
Because I know that she did two evaluations, one in 2015 and again then another one in July 2016. And I know that you had indicated to her from the 2015 evaluation that she had some inaccuracies.
Yes.
Apparently, during that time, she claims that she read the material to you, and then I don't know if it was okay at that time or when you went back on 2016, you had a list of changes.
No, that never happened. In fact, when we were finishing the second evaluation, she left me in the lobby. I asked her, I said, I want to go over the evaluation that we had before. And she left me in the lobby saying she had errands to run and said, lock the door behind you. And I was left in the lobby just like, okay, but I wanted to go over the previous evaluation. And she's just like, no, just go ahead, and when you're done with your tests or whatever, slip it in the drawer and lock the door behind you. And she left. There was no going over anything.
So you had no time where you reported any kind of corrections to the report in 2015?
No, I never. I reported it, and I sent it to her by mail, because that's how I was advised to do it. But during the second evaluation, I wanted to go over it. Then you asked me if I went over it with, or she went over it with me. No, that never happened.
Okay. I have no further questions.
Thank you. Dr. Flowers, did you have any other questions?
Not at this time.
Mr. Cohen, Jan, would you go ahead and step back, please?
Thank you, Mr. Chairperson, members of the committee. It's hard to know how to respond. We covered these issues in our reporting or our response in great detail in terms of what the interactions were with the contention that there were mistakes, the efforts that were made to correct the mistakes. If you go to page 18 of our response, we went through and identified specifically the things that were identified in a conversation that took place between Dr. Graff and JN. We identified what exactly was identified as an issue and changes that were made in the 2016 to accommodate them. So we have, I'm just looking now, from page 17 through page 22, so for five pages we went through and identified the things that Dr. Graff was told for the 2015 evaluation, that JN identified as concerns and that Dr. Graff addressed with her in a telephone call.
That's right.
And then the changes that were made. So they were addressed. They were identified. They didn't change the evaluation. For the most part, JN is describing her dissatisfaction with DCS and the way it was handled with the police, with a variety of different people. And that may well have gone on, and that may well have been an issue. But we've given you the report. We've given you the file. We've given you a detailed evaluation to show you that Dr. Graff did an appropriate evaluation, relied upon the information given her in 2015, then adjusted in 2016. She relied on the information given her by DCS. She relied upon her testing. She based her use of the instruments and her recommendations on the literature. She's done everything here the way it's supposed to be done in evaluation. It's unfortunate that JM was dissatisfied with the overall process and what happened with the length of it and with her third child, but that was entirely within the hands of DCS in terms of how they handled it, and not with Dr. Graff. And again, I could go through item by item, but that's why we laid this out in so much detail, because we wanted to be clear about what Dr. Graff did, when she did it, how she did it, and how she complied in every respect with her responsibilities under the contract. Thank you.
Dr. Flowers, do you have any questions?
Not at this time.
Dr. Brundage, any follow-up?
I just would like to indicate to Dr. Graff and counsel, Mr. Cohen, that the response was very detailed and explained certainly their position of this case.
Thank you.
Thank you.
The committee will now begin deliberation. Please note that deliberation is the time for the committee members to deliberate the case among themselves without interruptions from complainants, licensees, or attorneys representing licensees. Dr. Flowers?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. This is obviously a very difficult situation. When it comes to family matters, there is always a lot of emotion. And indeed, when psychologists are asked to participate in any of these matters, there are many issues that are difficult to unravel. Sometimes the roles are not totally clear, especially to those who are being referred to the system. They just, like the complainant said, she wanted just to get through it and wasn't sure really who did what, but it was like, we need to get this done. And indeed, there are, you know, the report is quite detailed, and the rationale, I looked through it, and it does follow logic, but I also was concerned that regarding some of the, it appears to be discrepancies between the client's history and what was in the report. It did appear at times that things could be, you might say, slanted a certain way to sound more negative than they necessarily maybe had to be. And, you know, we're talking about kind of implying that she has low intellect or whatever, and I haven't done testing, but she sure seemed to talk well today. There are times when those factual issues of a client's life can and do affect how we make conclusions and diagnoses and recommendations. So I have those concerns as well. I'd like to hear also from other board members on this.
Dr. Brundage?
Chairman Donaldson. Chairman Donaldson?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. May I speak?
Yes, go ahead.
Okay. Very difficult case, and my sense is that I hear the distress in JN, and I also have carefully reviewed the material. I'm aware that within Dr. Graff's notes, she indicated that the 2015 evaluation, that JN had been compliant with the interview but resistant for testing, and in 2016, JN had been resistant to the interview but compliant with testing. And so anytime there is that kind of resistance. I always wonder if the test results can be really complete. I believe that there's a lot of problems with what JN states and what other documentation states. Certainly the information from DCS was concerning about the incidents around the suspected non-accidental trauma that her daughter received, that the hospital had enough concerns that they had called DCS. So it wasn't DCS pouncing. It was the hospital then responding as a mandatory reporter that they called DCS. Apparently, this had not been the first involvement from DCS, so it sparked that. I also noted that the guardian ad litem had some concerns and had declared that if JN refused DPT treatment, that she would advocate for severance. So this is a case that's been followed by a lot of different people. I think JN is stating that Dr. Graff's evaluation impaired her ability to move forward with the kids and severance. But it appears that there were many different organizations that had input into this decision. And looking at Dr. Graff's information, yes, I have questions. Certainly, JN seems to be very articulate, and I certainly would not agree on the assessment that was given in the 2015. I am concerned on the discrepancy between Dr. Graff's response that she did take these inconsistencies that JN had identified and incorporated in the later report. So, you know, I think I'm struggling. We fall in that difficult position of trying to be judge and jury and having two very different stories. So I'm confused, I guess. The end.
Thank you, Dr. Brundage. I have read all the material that was submitted, and I found the allegations submitted by JN and trying to understand what's going on. It's very complex. There's a lot of stuff going on in the background besides Dr. Graff's evaluation. If it was just Dr. Graff's evaluation that we were dealing with, it'd be more understandable, but there's a lot of stuff in history and in background that was affecting DCS as a decision what they were going to do. It wasn't, in my opinion, wasn't just Dr. Graff's evaluation. I thought that Dr. Graff's timely responses to be very thorough and well organized. It was very easy to read it and to understand what was going on. And I appreciated the fact that Dr. Graff's responses, in my opinion, to be respectful of JN and her family in spite of the difficult DCS case. Dr. Flowers, would you like to make a motion?
Yes. You know, this is very difficult. I don't see any clear violation. I certainly see some concerns. But I'd like to make a motion that complaint number 18-22 be dismissed, as there's no evidence of violation of statutes or rules by the licensee.
I would second that.
Further discussion? All in favor of the motion say aye.
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 Opposed by the same sign? Motion carries. Complaint number 18-22 is dismissed. Thank you. See, the next one is case number T-18-24, Daniel Nightingale, Ph.D., and I'm doing the summary on this. I'm using the initials of the complainant in this. There were a number of allegations that K.R. submitted to our Board of Psychology Examiners. I've only listed here today the allegations that are within our scope of legal authority to consider and determine if the statute violation has occurred. KR complains the following, that Dr. Nightingale is practicing psychology and psychotherapy in Arizona without being licensed as a psychologist. He further asserts that Dr. Nightingale and his wife practice hypnotherapy in Arizona without being licensed. On August 23, 2018, the board received an additional information from KR to include the following. KR submitted a complaint that the Board of Behavioral Health Examiners was put in. Dr. Nightingale lectured at KR's former employee's dental office in Surprise, Arizona. Dr. Nightingale falsely stated dentists, nurses, and caregivers could receive continuing education as his six-hour lecture was accredited by various agencies. KR states that Dr. Nightingale, because Dr. Nightingale had falsely claimed that his lecture was accredited, the dental practice had to pay $2,000 to obtain accreditation for the lecture. KR states that Dr. Nightingale flew in from New York and had not made arrangements to stay overnight anywhere. Dr. Nightingale attempted to stay at the practice owner's home. Additionally, KR declares that Dr. Nightingale misrepresented credentials and his lecture was unprofessional. Dr. Nightingale responded in a timely manner, and his complaint response indicates the following. Dr. Nightingale states that he recently moved to Arizona from New York and apologized for any violation of Arizona statute and rules. Dr. Rowling KR states that he is a hypnopsychotherapist. His credentials were obtained in the United Kingdom. Dr. Nightingale states that he is an expert in the field of dementia and has received awards for his work. Additionally, his work has been published in the United States and in Europe. Dr. Nightingale denies inappropriately hugging KR. He explains that KR was an employee of the dental practice that he lectured at. On October 15, 2018, the board office received additional information from Dr. Nightingale. Dr. Nightingale confirms that he provides equine therapy. He explains that the Soquelli Sanctuary is a nonprofit organization. The services include equine therapy and hypnotherapy. There's a lot of stuff that Dr. Nightingale includes, but I don't think it really applies to the case at all in question. And that's my summary. Is Dr. Nightingale here? No. Okay. Dr. Brundage?
Yes, Mr. Donaldson.
Any comments?
I have many. I found that, again, questioning Dr. Nightingale, Nightingale's I found that it was extremely confusing as to how Dr. Nightingale presented himself. Again, he claimed to have a PhD. However, with the information that he provided us, I did not see any kind of organized program or even academic setting that would be able to give that. I would note on page 42 of 80 that he has a certificate from the European Certificate of Clinical Hypnosis that he has had not less than 1,400 hours as approved in hypnotherapy, psychotherapy. You know, at this point, we are not regulating hypnosis. I am a clinical member of the American Society of Clinical Hypnosis, which is a bona fide group, and I am unclear as to whether or not they recognize any of their European counterparts. His claim on dementia and being able to help, he does have books that he's written, but there's also this almost there's a very strong entertaining aspect of it, where he, you know, is known as a person who does humor, adult stand-up comedy, and really is not presenting himself in a favorable light if he really wants to be considered as someone in the field. He claims that he has removed everything and he's gone back to New York or the Britain, but at this point I do have real concerns about how he's presenting himself. Now, he did indicate that he had trained with Patch Adams, which is page 65 of our information. And, you know, obviously I think we recognize that Dr. Adams has some merit within the humor. But he just seems, there's a charlatan quality that I am concerned about. And, you know, I think that charging to go in and do these things, it feels as if he's claiming to be much more the professional than he is.
Okay, one thing I noted right off, too, he is not licensed in the state of Arizona. He's not...
any levels. Correct.
Yeah, he's not accredited in Arizona. Dr. Flowers.
Yes, from what I gather, the complainant is not present, right?
Right.
Okay. Now, looking at this, Dr. Nightingale, I believe, sent a message to the board staff saying that he's... involved in providing work for people in the UK today and can't attend.
Yes.
You know, looking at all of his letters after his name, I think I know what PhD is in RN, ADHD, maybe that's hypnosis, ECCH, entertainment, I don't know. But when I looked at his, background, it says I got my background in UK. And that's it, his training. And I don't think that sounds really good on a resume. It'd be like if I went to England and said, I got my training in the U.S. Nice, what did you do? And I've been recognized by different places and written books. That's nice. That doesn't necessarily mean that you have any adequate training. I have many concerns. We don't know what, if any, credentials he truly has. Certainly, he's not licensed with the Board of Behavioral Health or with the Board of Psychologists. He does say he does a number of things. The board staff made quite a few indications, like advertisements, that he says he's a general psychotherapist. And he... it said that he was providing psychotherapy at his office in Tempe. He has a Psychology Today profile. Says he's a dementia expert. I have, it may sound maybe rude, but I really don't know what that means. It implies medical training. Then I look at maybe he has an RN. We don't know. Many questions, and one concern, he does talk about doing things by phone or online, so I'm wondering, and he does say now he's just doing psychotherapy for people in the UK, we don't know, but does that mean he's doing it by doing Skype in Tempe? We don't know. And so when he says, he did send a letter to the board staff saying that he was appreciative of the input and he's taken action as directed, I really don't know if he has. And even if he said he had, I'd still be concerned he might be doing something else within the state of Arizona, reaching out elsewhere. Maybe he's on the phone with people in the UK today in his office in Tempe. It kind of implies he flew over there to participate in something. We don't know. But I would not feel comfortable simply saying, he said he complied, sounds good to me, let's close it. I think it really needs to be pursued.
I think so.
Chairman Donaldson?
Yes, go ahead, Dr. Brindage.
I'm sorry. I think that his Facebook pages are very misleading. I know at this point, looking at page 65, there are numerous photos of Ault where he is standing next to the Royal Society of Medicine. On page 80 of the information that we have, he claims that he's world-renowned. I am extremely concerned. I don't think that at this point that we just ignore this. I would recommend that we move further and maybe have a cease or desist or whatever appropriate. He has been contacted by the board. He indicates that he's made some changes, but I don't think the changes are clear enough to protect the public of Arizona.
Yes, and I don't know if we, at what level the cease and desist order can come, whether we can or if it needs to go to the full board. But you know, my concern is he could indeed be committing fraud and having a home base in Tempe.
Yes, our attorney told us that the cease and desist order would have to come from the full board.
Okay, I also wanted to note, on page, let's see if I can find it here, of our documentation, I'm on page 63. It says, my QK profile on Psychology Today, Skype or Zoom consults only. So apparently he is doing something via Skype. Okay, Skype does not sound like encrypted telemedicine to me. And what indeed is he doing? It's just many, many troubling things.
Chairman Donaldson?
Yes, go ahead.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Oh, go ahead.
No, I don't. Dr. Flowers, finish.
Oh, okay. I was going to say, if we do need to go to the full board to do the cease and desist and so forth, I think we need to proceed with that.
Chairman Donaldson, I'd like to make a motion.
Okay.
I would like to make a motion that the case between T-18-24 be forwarded to the full board for Daniel Nightingale with regard to representing himself as a behavioral, as a psychologist or psychotherapist and without the credentials.
I second the motion.
I don't know if we can do this, direct the staff to further look at Psychology Today and check some of the people because just to be honest, I went into the internet and checked Psychology Today, and I find that not only is Dr. Nightingale using the word psychology, so is his wife and other people. Practices or that are not licensed by this board. There are some in psychology that are licensed, but some that are not.
Yes, and Mr. Chairman, if the board could also just check to get any kind of current information on what indeed he has done with his online presence with these different areas that they looked at before. There seemed to be like they're all over the place.
Yes.
And he said he changed it. We don't know. But even if, you know, hopefully he has, but even at that, I agree with Dr. Brundage that it still would need to go forward anyway.
Yes. Further discussion?
Mr. Donaldson?
Yes.
I would say that at this point, I know that oftentimes we indicate a problem of ARS. I think that at this point we could identify ARS-32-2084 violations and impersonating a member of the board in order to issue a light. Well, yeah, I just think that he is misrepresenting himself.
Well, indeed, it does say part of the designation says use any combination of words, initials, and symbols that leads the public to believe the person's licensed to practice psychology in the state.
Perhaps ARS 32-2083 would be more accurate. A person not licensed pursuant to this chapter from practicing psychology.
Okay, yeah, that would be good as well.
Now, that's injunction, but I don't know. At least at this point, that would move it ahead so the full board could review the material.
Yes, maybe that just could just be added, and then we have both. Whatever works to get it forward, I will agree with.
So all those comments are added to the motion?
That's correct. It's my understanding, Mr. Chairman, members of the board, that the committee wants to advance this to the board regarding Dr. Nightingale's use of psychotherapist and psychologist in possible violations of 32-2084 and 2083. Is that correct, Dr. Bundage?
That is correct.
Would that include his wife also?
That's not before you. If you want to, you know, I think the committee could vote to open up a complaint and have the staff investigate his wife, but this matter is only involving Dr. Nightingale, as I understand.
That concerns Dr. Nightingale. Further discussion?
Chairman Donaldson?
Go ahead.
I have one other question. Would it be possible to subpoena Dr. Nightingale so that we actually have him in the same room so that we can ask questions regarding this matter?
I think that would be something that could be done at the board level. He'll certainly be notified. My understanding is that he'll be notified, and certainly board staff in that notification can indicate the committee's, you know, preference that he be present for this meeting, for the board meeting. And if for some reason at that board meeting he's not there, I believe that it's at that time that the board could continue the matter and subpoena Dr. Nightingale to appear at a future meeting.
Chairman Donaldson, Mr. Harris, I am concerned enough about this case that I am uncomfortable with the delay that would create. Is it possible before the case is heard by the full board to actually have him come in? Because again, you know, if we cover this in a full board, then we subpoena, it's a delay, and I just think that this person has potential for real problem.
Yeah. Madam, excuse me, Mr. Chairman.
Yes, go ahead.
Dr. Brunge has been chair for so long, I get confused, but I wonder if it would be in the situation of having like an emergency board meeting by phone, because that would expedite it.
You know,
I don't. Would it be? Do you think it would be in that category of level of concern?
I know our next full board meeting will be in our in-person meeting will be the second week in February.
Okay, I believe it's February 8th.
Correct. My sense is that it could be at least reviewed at that time, but I really would like to have Dr. Nightingale present. Mr. Harris, what I'm hearing from you is that the full board can only take that action, that we'd have to wait.
That is correct. Now, when it comes before the board in February, and if Dr. Nightingale is not present, the board can certainly consider all of its options that are available, including subpoenaing Dr. Nightingale, and maybe if they felt necessary to hold a meeting between the next regularly scheduled meeting to hear from Dr. Nightingale to move this case forward. So they'll have their options available to them to expedite things if, in fact, Dr. Nightingale is not present. And again, I think that's something that board staff can certainly communicate to Dr. Nightingale, the importance of his presence when the board convenes in February.
Thank you. I have no further questions.
Further discussion?
Do we have, I guess a motion was made. I don't know if we've actually voted on it yet.
We're in the process of doing that.
Oh, okay.
We got discussion.
Okay. I think Dr. Brundage was saying, cited ARS 32-2083 and ARS 32-2084, mm-hmm. that it go to the full board for for initial review?
Yes.
Correct. Yeah. Is that correct? So, and I believe I did a second on that, and then we had a discussion.
Mm-hmm. Call the question.
All in favor, motion say aye.
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 Opposed by the same sign. Motion carries. Is it the pleasure of the committee to open a complaint against his wife?
Yes.
Is there a motion?
Chairman Donaldson, I'm unclear, but I don't believe we can do this at that time because it's not agenda. It's not on the agenda.
Okay.
And I'll defer to past practices. Maybe what you could do is make a motion to refer to the board the possibility of looking into opening up a complaint against his wife. So when it comes to the board in February, Dr. Nightingale's case, we can properly agendize perhaps opening up a complaint against his wife for the unauthorized practice of psychology.
It's not.
I would support that.
It's not uncommon for the staff, board staff, open complaint either. It's not uncommon for the board staff to initiate a complaint if they discover that she is using terms of psychology in her evidence.
Yeah, it would be my understanding, and I'll defer to Ms. Jones, but if during the course of an investigation they uncover possible violation from another professional or another individual, that they would reflect that in the board information and then defer to the board on whether or not to pursue a complaint against another individual. Is that how is that consistent?
Yes.
So.
Okay.
We can prepare all that information for the February meeting, as the committee has directed and requested that we do, and then the board can review that.
Great. Okay. Motion carries. Next. Next complaint is complaint number 18-24, Amy Goldstein, Dr. Flowers.
Yes, just a second. I need to scroll down to my information on that case. Okay. I'm not sure. Well, maybe it's a procedural question. I'm ready to present the case. I can do that, but one key issue here is we lack records in regards to the case. And without that, I don't know that we can fully adjudicate it. But if you would like me to proceed, I certainly will.
Dr. Flowers, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'll defer to the will of the committee, but if you believe that at the end of your presentation, Dr. Flowers, that the committee doesn't have sufficient information to take dispositive action, then perhaps what we should do is entertain continuing this matter to obtain that additional information and bring it back to you once the board has required that. But I would be specific as to what it is that we don't have to help board staff in obtaining that additional information. And I don't know if you want to hear from board staff with respect to that.
Well, what I could do is state what I understand. And certainly I want to hear. I know board staff has certainly made efforts. But looking at it, it appears that Dr. Johansson, who's the complainant, works for Northern Arizona VA Healthcare System in Prescott, and that the board staff has made efforts to get the records through the Tucson VA system and the Phoenix VA system without success. And I'm just wondering, you know, working for the federal government for a long, long time, I wonder if it would be more productive to address the concerns and so forth through the Northern Arizona VA system in Prescott, or if it's kind of all the same organization. If we have a definitive, you know, the VA will not give us this information, I can proceed on that basis, but at some point I want to be comfortable that indeed all efforts have been tried before we proceed with kind of like limited information.
Chairman Donaldson?
Yes, please.
I'm having some difficulty hearing you, but I believe you gave me the floor?
Yes.
Okay. I'm aware that the allegations were more regarding practicing outside of scope of practice, and within that area, it had been around the evaluation of diagnosis of traumatic brain injury and whether or not the licensee had the appropriate experience. And again, I think that the response from the attorney outlined clearly what that a psychologist no longer could diagnose that, but certainly could provide information about that. About that issue. We have many psychologists who are working in the healthcare field who have developed expertise in the area that they focus on, and certainly Dr. Goldstein has had an extensive experience in the neuropsychological areas. I would believe that neuropsychological training would allow her at least to be able to identify traumatic brain injury. So, yes, it's frustrating that we don't have the information, but I know that board has been fairly diligent about trying to request that information, and at this point we don't have it. I would hate for this to continue to float, because there's part of me that wonders if we'll ever have it. So I would like to proceed with the understanding that board has done their due diligence and the VA is refusing to provide those records.
Okay, Mr. Chairman,
yes.
Please, I can proceed. I'm good either way. I just wanted to point out that issue.
And Dr. Goldstein is with her attorney is here today also.
Okay.
And Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, one thing you may want to do is hear from board staff to assure you the lengths that they went to obtain the records and were unsuccessful based upon their communications and contact with the VA, if you would find that information to be useful.
Yes, it wasn't like they just called last week, you know, kind of thing. There have been significant efforts.
Exactly.
If you'd like, Mr. Chairman, I'll just go ahead and do the, I'll just present the case.
Okay, go right ahead.
Okay, the complaint is from Dr. Johnson. Alleged that Dr. Goldstein is practicing outside of the scope of her expertise by conducting traumatic brain injury evaluations. Dr. Johansson said the Office of Disability and Medical Assessment, DMA, prescribes rules regarding TBIs and that only psychiatrists, neurosurgeons, and neurologists can conduct TBI evaluations. He said that Dr. Goldstein does not meet those requirements. Dr. Johansson said that he reviewed a report by Dr. Goldstein and that Dr. Goldstein opined on TBI, migraines, and Meniere's disease in her evaluation of the veteran. He said that the only testing provided was the cognitive assessment test, MoCA. Dr. Johansson said that other testing should have been administered in a TBI evaluation. Dr. Goldstein, through her attorney, said the following. She attended the Albert Einstein College of Medicine and, I'll probably say it wrong, Virchow Graduate School of Psychology. She was trained in neuropsychology in her graduate training and in her postdoctoral experiences. For more than 25 years, she's been conducting neuropsychological and psychological evaluations. In May 2018, she contracted with Quality, Timeliness, and Customer Service to conduct compensation and pension examinations for the Department of Veterans Affairs. She's conducted more than 100 evaluations since being contracted with QTC. Dr. Goldstein says that part of the guidelines within the VBA say that she's qualified to perform both initial mental health disorder examinations and mental disorder review or increased evaluation mental disorder examinations. She's never made an initial diagnosis of TBI. She said that other professionals are authorized to conduct further evaluations after the initial diagnosis of TBI has been made. QTC does not maintain patient records. When conducting these kind of evaluations, she's provided electronic access to the veteran's medical records, conducts a face-to-face structured interview with a veteran, follows the nationwide online forms required by QTC and the veterans, the VBA. When conducting review examinations, she asks similar questions that are on the VA's disability benefits questionnaire. The form asks questions about headaches and Meniere's disease, but she only documents whether the veteran has them. The VA mandates what testings to be performed, and she's almost always required to use the Montreal Cognitive Assessment, the MoCA. She has not diagnosed migraines or Meniere's disease. She does include previously given diagnoses and symptoms in her reports. She denied violating any ethical principles. She said that the lack of access to records regarding the case make it difficult to respond more fully to the complaint. And this concludes my summary of the case.
Okay, thank you, Dr. Flowers. Dr. Goldstein, attorney, please come forward.
May I just check with you to ensure that the complainant is not here wanting to appear telephonically first?
No one's on.
I've not received a request to speak.
All right, thank you.
Nope.
Well, we had a nice opening presentation ready for you until Dr. Flowers did such a fabulous job. He stole our thunder. I think he aptly indicated what the concerns and issues are here. In a nutshell, can I just simply say, I think the misunderstanding here with the person from the Northern Arizona Prescott VA is, there's a difference between making an initial diagnosis of TBI as opposed to being a person assigned to do a reevaluation, an update assessment. They're for totally different purposes. And if you think about it for a minute, most of the TBI diagnoses that are made are done in the field. They're done at the time, shortly after there's been an injury related to combat. And it certainly isn't sitting in someone's office back here in the United States years later after the fact. So that is a change in the system that's fairly recent, and it's simply possible that Dr. Johansson didn't realize that the diagnosis had already been made previously, and that according to all the VA statutes and rules, Dr. Goldstein is perfectly qualified and fully authorized to deal with that after the fact as part of a review assessment. So that's our understanding of where there may be some confusion here. As far as the Meniere's and the headaches, same thing. She didn't make any diagnosis on those. The only thing she does is she's given a checklist of different items that might be related to TBI. And she's asked to just go through, and any time there's information in the patient's records or the patient self-reports that they've been diagnosed with that, a little check mark goes there. But it certainly doesn't involve the full scope of information seeking that you'd need in order to initially make that diagnosis, and she doesn't. Otherwise, we don't think that Dr. Goldstein did anything wrong here, and I think, as I pointed out in our brief for you, that it's unfortunate that the complainant didn't come forth to talk directly with Dr. Goldstein or to go to her supervisor or to talk to anyone from QTC. They're the biggest federal contractor in the United States for VA assessments, you would think that they would know what they're doing. If he had a problem with any of her work, why not take it to a supervisor, run it up the chain of command, go over to QTC, and talk it through? Instead, there's just this complaint shows up with no explanation. There's never been any other complaints filed against Dr. Goldstein, and so we're happy to answer any questions, but we think this is a case that should be dismissed.
Dr. Goldstein, you have any comments?
No.
Dr. Flowers, you have any questions?
Not at this time.
Dr. Brundage? Dr. Brundage? Dr. Brundage? Did she leave us? Dr. Brundage, do you have your machine on mute?
Okay, I hear some promising ringing there.
Yes, it did. I just want to let you know, I'm trying to call in, but my phone is totally dead.
Can I pick you
up?
Can I pick you up?
Well, I'll insert my comments while Dr. Brundage is working out her thing there.
Okay, sure.
As I read the information, I agree. The Dr. Goldstein's job was to review what's already been done, and she wasn't making any diagnosis. And as I've read more of this stuff on TBI policy and the attempt of the federal government to figure out what they were doing, I thought, good grief, how does anybody involved in diagnosing and evaluating TBI come to any good conclusions? It's not going to be refuted later on. So it's, and I've been through this before with other things like Medicare, for instance. It changes practically every hour. And you can be fined for having missed the change that happened the last hour. And if you're still practicing by what you thought was right, you can be fined. Thing is, I saw this as I read the information is and having worked with the federal government, amazing. And these are folks, people in the field that absolutely need some help. And meanwhile, back at the ranch, the government's trying to figure out what their piece of this is. But I agree. Dr. Goldstein was just doing her job in reviewing what has already been done, not making any diagnosis. Okay, Dr. Brundage, go ahead.
Dr. Chairman Donaldson, I am back on my cell phone. I was disconnected from the other phone as it happened last week, and it is locked up my landline, and I can't seem to call in. Can you hear me?
Quite well.
Excellent. All right. Thank you. I did have some struggles, so I would ask people to speak loudly. I find that certainly with Dr. Goldstein's background, her training, her extensive work in neuropsychology, that she did follow protocol. One reason I would want to see the case is that she said that she had completed that TBI cases that she reviewed all had been previously examined and diagnosed by the required specialist. I think that the only suggestion I would have is that within her report she could at least identify that those are the practitioners that can officially give a diagnosis. But I also believe that she worked within her scope and training. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. Dr. Brundage.
Yes, go ahead. I'd like to make a motion.
Okay.
But looking at this, I believe also that the licensee and her attorney provided credible information in the response to the complaint. I move that the complaint 18-24, be dismissed as there's no evidence of violation of statutes or rules by the licensee.
I would second that.
Further discussion? All in favor of the motion, say aye.
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 Opposed by the same sign? Motion carries. Complaint number 18-24 is dismissed.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.
The next case is mine for summary. That's number 18-27. Dr. Tanzi.
Actually, we're going to do that one last.
Do this one last? Okay, Dr. Malone. Okay, Tanzi's last. Okay, summary of 18-28. Complainant JL sought Dr. Malone's services for her 10-year-old daughter, KL, and JL states that she took KL to Dr. Malone for a scheduled appointment and believes that Dr. Malone was inebriated. JL states that Dr. Malone was slurring, stumbling, and repeating her comments. JL declares that she lived with alcoholics and recognized the signs of alcoholism. The board staff conducted a phone interview with the complainant on October 18, 2018. JL states that when she and her daughter approached Dr. Malone's front door for an appointment in question, Dr. Malone's cell phone was on the ground outside. When Dr. Malone answered the door, she indicated that she did not remember leaving her cell phone outside. The phone interview reinstated much of the same information as received initially. On October 22, 2018, the board's executive director conducted a phone interview with Dr. Malone. Dr. Malone had received the complaint from the board office and was preparing a response. Dr. Malone said that on the day in question, she was suffering from a severe migraine. She claimed that to have canceled all of her appointments except the one resulting in this complaint. She stated that because the client was at her office, she did her best to follow through with the appointment. Dr. Malone insists that she does not have an alcohol problem. Dr. Malone's response was received in a timely manner. Dr. Malone states that on September 24, 2018, she was suffering from a migraine headache and believed that she had canceled all of her appointments for that day. Dr. Malone confirms that she failed to cancel KL's appointment that was scheduled for 3:45 p.m. that day. Dr. Malone states that JL and KL showed up for the scheduled 3:45 p.m. appointment. At that time, Dr. Malone divulged that she had been suffering from a migraine and thought that she had canceled all of her appointments for the day. She apologized for her oversight. Dr. Malone claims that after she disclosed that she was suffering from a migraine, she offered to continue the session since they were already there. She alleges that JL and KL agreed to continue with the session knowing that she was suffering from a migraine. Dr. Malone states that KL was scheduled for an appointment on October 1st, 2018, but did not show up for the session. Dr. Malone called JL to inquire about the missed appointment. JL declared that she was discontinuing service with Dr. Malone. JL explained to Dr. Malone that she believed Dr. Malone was inebriated during the September 24, 2018 session. Dr. Malone reiterates that she was not inebriated, but was suffering a migraine. Dr. Malone apologizes to JL for not calling to cancel appointment. Additionally, Dr. Malone told JL that she would not be charging for the September 24, 2018 session. Dr. Malone states that it appeared that JL was satisfied with the conversation. That concludes my summary. Dr. Brundage. Well, wait a minute. Dr. Malone.
Good morning.
Here. Go ahead.
I saw the patient, I'll just call her K, that's right. I saw the patient three times. She's 10 years old. The mother brought her to our first session and stayed.
Chairman Donaldson?
Yes, louder.
If you were to remind licensee to speak loud.
Speak loud.
I'll do that. Thank you.
Just bring it closer. It works.
If I may take my sunglasses off, I would appreciate it.
Fine.
Fluorescent lights give me headaches, and if you're all right with that, I'd prefer.
That's fine.
Thank
That's
you.
Fine.
I did see Kay for three sessions. The mother attended the first two sessions.
Unfortunately, I'm sorry, but I can't hear a word.
You're going to have to put yes. Thank you.
All right. The mother attended the first two sessions for approximately 10 minutes.
How's that, Dr. Brundage?
It's very low, but at least I can figure out their words.
I'm sorry, I have a slow and low voice. I'll speak as loudly as I'm able to. Thank you. The mother, as I said, attended the first two sessions for approximately 10 minutes and attended the third session in its entirety. She brought in her son, the autistic son, and he sat in the living room of my home as I operate out of my home office. Currently.
Dr. Brundage, can you hear that?
Again, very light, but I can get the gist. Would she still speak louder?
Would it help if she came up closer to the phone?
No, it's going through the microphone.
We'll try this. All right.
Go ahead.
All right. The young lady, Kay, is 10 years old, and I did see her brother as well for one session. He is 16. He had decided to not attend further sessions as there were family problems, father being alcoholic, and he did not want to speak about that. The 12-year-old sat in the living room of my home, and I had my office doors open so he could hear us and we could see and keep an eye on him as well. The mother chose to stay for the entire session. The young lady originally came to me based on the fact that her parents were divorcing. She was very upset and not wanting the divorce. Being a child, obviously, had little or no control over that. The mother stated that both her father, the mother's father and the mother's husband were alcoholics. The mother left the first two sessions after 10 minutes or so, as I said, to attend to her son. During those sessions, the young lady was very open and honest about what was going on and what she was feeling. We went through incomplete sentences where she was able to further disclose that she was very tearful and that her mom cried a lot. The young lady who was my patient came home early from a bike ride and heard her mom and father arguing, and she was very upset. I will respond to any questions you care to ask. If you care for more information or if you would like me to read my progress notes, I am happy to do so.
Dr. Brundage, do you have any questions? Dr. Brundage, do you have any questions? Dr. Brundage, do you have any questions?
Yes, I do. I think one of the questions I have for Dr. Malone is whether or not she had taken medications with regard to addressing her migraine.
I have in the past. I have not taken medications other than Aleve for approximately 10 years. I did state that I was having a migraine, in that I apologized for not canceling that appointment, as I had canceled all other appointments on that day. It was my oversight
in my neglect to not have called her.
Did you get that, Dr. Brundage?
Yes, I have other questions.
Yes.
I noted in your progress notes that the note for September 24th, 2018 is very unlike your writing anywhere else.
Yes.
I think, again, obviously that between the comments from the client and your writing, it seemed that you were fairly impaired.
I was experiencing a very severe migraine, and that also could explain why the handwriting on that date was much different than on other dates.
No further questions.
Dr. Flowers?
Yes, I have several. On that date, I'm wondering if you were taking any medication or substances that may have affected your ability to provide services.
I had taken two Aleve in the morning and drinking water. Due to my migraine, I don't recall eating lunch. I had had two Aleve, and I take no other medications. I take one medication in the evening for sleep and have for 35 or 40 years.
Okay, but no, I mean, when I said substance, otherwise you deny any like use of alcohol or any psychoactive involvement at that time?
Nothing, just the two Aleve.
Did you feel able to perform services that day?
I explained to the mother that I had been experiencing a migraine all day, and we had mutually agreed to follow through with the session.
Okay, but it sounds it's almost like you're telling the mother that you were kind of like somewhat impaired.
I did tell her I had been experiencing a migraine all day.
Okay. I'm wondering, looking at the records that we were given, did we receive all the client records and what you gave to us?
Yes, I did. I believe I have.
Okay.
I can give you the dates. September 10th, first date of the first session. September 17th. Second session, and September 24th, third session, final session.
Okay. Within that, I just saw handwritten notes, but I didn't see like an intake evaluation, treatment plan, or informed consent. Were really like notes that had mental status examinations, diagnoses, were those done?
The diagnosis for this young lady was F43.3.
Actually, yeah, you don't need to tell. I was not really clear that was included within your notes or like an intake evaluation.
That was at the very top of the 9, 10, 18 intake information which the mother provided. At the very top right is the diagnosis, and both the clinical numbering and the verbal written.
Okay, but I guess, what I'm saying is I didn't really see a workup with the diagnosis, with the symptoms and so forth to have that conclusion. So it sounds as if you were just given that information by the mother and proceeded. Is that kind of how it was, or am I overstating?
The mom stayed for about 10 minutes in order to fill out the intake information. And if you'll look at my note from September 10th on the far right side, are my notes as far as what led me to the diagnosis.
Okay, let's see. So some other things here.
If you would like me to read them, say, well.
Oh, no, I could pretty well read through them myself. And I'm wondering, too, within one of the sessions, you gave information to, I guess, Kay about the brother's participation in counseling. That seemed unusual to me.
It did to me also. I did speak with Kay, when she asked why her brother was not continuing, and I explained to her that he just did not want to talk about the divorce.
Okay, I was just confused as to, that disclosure, that kind of thing. But I didn't see informed consent or how confidentiality would work documented within the notes either. So I'm concerned about the record keeping and the diagnostic workup and that kind of thing. Anyway, those are my questions, comment to this point. Thank you.
Thank you.
Dr. Malone, as a public member, I'm asking you about your migraines. How often does that occur?
Roughly 4 to 6 times per year. Many years ago, 2 to 3 times per week.
How often do you cancel appointments because of the severe migraines?
If patients are scheduled on days that I have a migraine, I do cancel them. And I'm sorry, I do not know, for example, during the last year, which dates I had my migraines or which dates I canceled patients. But when I awaken with one, I cancel immediately and explain briefly that I'm having a severe headache and that I would call the next day to reschedule.
Yes, I'm concerned about some of the stuff that Dr. Flowers has highlighted here, record keeping and that kind of stuff. I'm wondering if your migraines affect your ability to do those functions as a psychologist.
Not on my day-to-day, not daily, not when I see patients not experiencing a migraine. If you will note, which you have noted, on September 24th, the handwriting is different, the everything is different, which to me, even looking at the notes, suggests something was going on, and it was a migraine. As I stated, I did cancel all patients that day. It was my neglect to not cancel that last patient. I had a line drawn through all of the patients for that day, neglected to draw the line through, and neglected to call the mother to cancel that appointment.
So, Dr. Malone, if, in hindsight, would you have done things differently in treating JL?
I did explain when they arrived that I was experiencing a migraine, and we jointly decided to continue with the session.
But in hindsight, would you have done anything differently?
I would have approached it in the same way and suggested that she call me the next day to reschedule. However, it was agreed upon amongst the three of us to continue with the session. The mother went out to the car to get her son, who is autistic, and he, as I said, sat in the living room with my office doors open so that we could all see him.
I see. Thank you. Dr. Brundy, are you still with us?
I am, and I'm back. I was able to reconnect. So thank you all for putting up with the logistics of a telephone system that's gone awry.
No problem. Go ahead.
I continue to have questions with Dr. Malone. You left the door open. Is that not a violation of HIPAA in that form?
Perhaps if I explain my office setup, I'm currently operating from a home office. I had the front door closed immediately upon entering the front door. My office is the first door on the left. From those two doors, double doors, it opens into the entryway. From there is a view of the living room where the young boy was sitting. The mother had requested if it was all right, if he attended, if he came in, and it was fine for him. It was fine for me, his sister, and his mom. That way, the mother and myself could keep an eye on the young man.
I have a question, because in the information that we've received from mom, she's indicated that that she was asked to leave the room. And so your report is that mom never left the room?
In the first two sessions, the mother stayed for about 10 minutes. And at the third session, I asked if she would again like to leave the session, and she stated she would like to remain for the session, which was fine.
I have no questions at this time.
Thank you.
Dr. Flowers, any other questions?
None at this time.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you. You go ahead and step back, Dr. Malone.
Thank you.
The committee will now begin deliberation. Please note that deliberation is a time for the committee members to deliberate the case among themselves without interruptions from complainants, licensees, or attorneys representing the licensee. Dr. Brundage, would you like to begin?
I would. Chairman Donaldson and committee members, I continue to be really concerned about this case. We have severe allegations from the individual who was seen, from the mother. I believe that there was some type of information conveyed in the last day or two regarding the support of Dr. Malone, but also insisting that she had been impaired to the degree that her speech was slurred, that she appeared inebriated, she was stumbling and repeating her comments, that the cell phone was outside. Again, I am aware that some people have severe reactions to migraines, but I'm aware that most of the time, the folks who are really impacted that much generally are in a dark room lying down with something cold on their head. I'm having a hard time with this one, in that the paperwork is, I believe, below standard. The allegations are severe. I think that, again, if you have a severe migraine, I don't know how you would really be able to focus on a patient, even if they did show up and you received permission to proceed. I don't think it was in the best interest of that that person. So I'm not comfortable dismissing this. I think that there's enough questions I have that I would feel comfortable moving in on to the full board for review. Thank you.
Thank you. Dr. Flowers?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I share similar concerns. Certainly, even if a client is willing to participate in a session, it's really incumbent on the provider to ensure that he or she is able and appropriately and, you know, in the right mind, physical, mental, to proceed. Beyond that, looking at the documentation, I was very concerned, as I implied when I was talking to the licensee. It appears that there was minimal workup as far as deciding a treatment plan, and it was kind of like they showed up and wanted care, so care began without really a really significant workup, mental status examination, a treatment plan, those kind of things, and that's concerning as well. And discussing a client's participation with another one, you know, that potentially could be seen as inappropriate as far as confidentiality, but I don't see within the documentation that confidentiality issues were discussed as far as with informed consent about within the family or within the treatment, what agreements would be made about sharing of information. And of course, I'm concerned that there may be some impairment. We don't know exactly what it's from, but it is concerning. And for those concerns, I agree with Dr. Brundage that this would warrant the case being sent to the full board for an initial review.
Thank you, Dr. Flowers. This case also concerns me from a public point of view, is that Dr. Malone thought it necessary to cancel all of her appointments because she was suffering a severe migraine. But yet, as Dr. Flowers, I think Dr. Brundage also pointed out that Dr. Malone is the professional here. And from a professional point of view, I think if it was necessary to cancel all those other appointments, and she felt at that time she was not up to par to adequately treat those people she had scheduled, I didn't think it was in the best interest of JL to continue treatment. Dr. Brundage, it sounded like you were in the process of a motion.
I was, but I also wanted to clarify. We received from Ms. Broaddus an email report from JL, and within that, though that was a reference, it was sent this morning at 8:16. But within that, it again indicated that JL indicated that Dr. Malone came to the drug door visibly drunk and staggering. She needed to lean against the doorframe and wall to remain upright. During the session, Dr. Malone asked the same questions repeatedly and had no recollection of prior exchanges. She strongly insisted that she meet alone with my young child, which made me extremely uncomfortable. We left as soon as possible because I wanted to remove my child. She did indicate that overall she had been impressed with Dr. Malone's professional skill and empathy, and that she created a warm nurturing environment which helped her children develop new coping strategies. And her hope was that Dr. Malone could receive treatment. I would like to make a motion that the case of 18-28 be forwarded to the full board of Gloria Malone, PhD. I believe that at this point there are some questions about impairment levels and also the documentation levels. So what I would say is that let's look at ARS 32-2061. We could go, providing services that are unnecessary or unsafe or otherwise in engaging in activities as a psychologist that are unprofessional by current standards. I also think that, and I'm looking for the impairment.
It's L.
L, that I would also include L. Practicing psychology while impaired or incapacitated to the extent and in a manner that jeopardizes the welfare of the client or patient or renders the psychological services provided ineffective. and I believe that we've acknowledged that. And then we also, I think, have concerns about the record keeping.
That'd be H.
Thank you, Doctor.
Oh, no problem. Yeah, I was ready to make a motion, too. So.
All right. And that would, again, be H, failing or refusing to maintain and retain adequate business, financial, or professional records pertaining to the psychological services provided in a client or patient. Those are my concerns.
Yes, I also second the motion.
Great. Do we have a motion? Further discussion? All in favor of the motion say aye.
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 Aye. Opposed by the same sign? Motion carries. So, complaint number 18-26 28 is being sent to the full board for their consideration. Thank you. Moving next, this is where we lose Dr. Brundage?
Correct. And Chairman Donaldson, I must recuse from this case.
Thank you.
Normally, I would walk out of the room. However, since I'm on the telephone, I'm going to hang up.
Again.
Thank you. Thank you for your good work.
Thank you, and I apologize for the my delay this morning. Bye.
Hey, no problem. Okay. I give the summary on this one here, number 18-27. Dear and his wife, mother, started taking their 13-year-old minor son, ZR, to Dr. Tanzi for counseling. DR declares that ZR began seeing Dr. Tanzi. On October 15, 2010, ZR had an 8 a.m. counseling session with Dr. Tanzi. ZR went into the session with Dr. Tanzi. On the drive home, father asked ZR how the session went for him. ZR responded that the session was fine but reported seeing pornography on Dr. Tanzi's computer screen when he first entered Dr. Tanzi's office. ZR's mother asked ZR about what he saw on Dr. Tanzi's computer screen. ZR reported seeing a naked woman touching her breasts. At 8:56 a.m. that same day, father called Dr. Tanzi and left a voicemail. At 9:25 a.m., Dr. Tanzi returned father's phone call. Father questioned Dr. Tanzi about the pornography on his computer screen. Dr. Tanzi replied that it was true that he had pornography on his computer screen, stating that, "I thought I was able to block ZR from seeing it and shut it down right away, but I guess he saw it." Father declares that this incident is very disturbing to me and my family. Father states that he and mother took ZR to a highly reputable child psychologist only to have ZR exposed to pornography. Father concedes that Dr. Tanzi's intent to emotionally harm our son is a huge concern for us as parents. Father states that Dr. Tanzi was unethical, unprofessional, and believes that Dr. Tanzi exposing a 13-year-old child for pornography is also illegal. Dr. Tanzi provided background information in a timely manner via his attorney. ZR was referred to him for anxiety and self-esteem issues. He began treating ZR on October 11, 2018. On October 15, 2018, ZR was scheduled for his second session. Dr. Tanzi further disagrees with ZR's father's statement that Dr. Tanzi intended to cause ZR emotional harm. That statement is not true. Dr. Tanzi has devoted his professional life to helping children deal with emotional problems. He would not do anything to cause harm to a child generally or to one of his patients specifically. The appearance of that image on his computer monitor was an unexpected event. As soon as Dr. Tanzi saw the image, he took action to try to prevent ZR from seeing the image and then removed the image from the screen as best he knows how. Dr. Tanzi would have discussed the fact that ZR had seen the image and any impact seeing the image had on ZR if Dr. Tanzi had any indication that ZR had seen the image. Dr. Tanzi would have discussed the presence of the image with ZR's parents if he had any indication that ZR had seen the image. He did not discuss the image with ZR or ZR's parents at the time of ZR's appointment because Dr. Tanzi genuinely believed that ZR had not seen the image when he walked into the room. When later that morning, ZR's father told Dr. Tansey that ZR had in fact seen the image, Dr. Tansey did not deny the fact that the image had been on his computer monitor screen. Rather, Dr. Tansey was candid and forthcoming with ZR's father when he learned that ZR had seen the image on the computer monitor screen. Dr. Tansey had no better explanation when he spoke with ZR's father on the morning of October 15, 2018 than he does now for why the image was on his computer monitor screen. Since Dr. Tansey did not find the image or any indication of how the image came to be on his computer's monitor screen, he is left to speculate about what happened. That speculation is based on things he read as he tried to understand what may have happened to cause that image to be on his computer screen, his computer monitor screen. Dr. Tansey has taken several actions to prevent such an occurrence from happening again. Dr. Tansey has taken the opportunity presented by the complainant to consider the implications of technology for the practice of, in this case, a technological mishap of some kind created a situation that could have had an adverse consequences for the patient who saw the image. Dr. Tansey has taken the corrective action described above to prevent this specific technological mishap or like technological mishaps from happening again. He has taken 2 continuing education classes to expand his knowledge about technology in professional practice and about risk management generally, so he can better prepared to anticipate and recognize technology risks and deal with them proactively, effectively. That's my summary. Dr. Tansey, complainants here, is the DR, would you please come forward?
Good morning.
Good morning.
Can everyone hear me fine?
Yes.
Thank you. Thank you for allowing me to make a brief statement. I'll try and keep my statements brief and not necessarily dispute the information that's been carried forth so far. I just would like to add some additional pieces that we've discussed at home in relationship to the case. To give a little bit of background in regards to why our son was being treated, he was being counseled due to being in a very fragile mental state at the time. He is currently 14, but he had just recently had a birthday. Just prior to us seeking counsel, our son had made a suicide attempt by trying to hang himself in our home. This was his first time seeing a counselor, and he did not know what to expect from any type of counseling session, but he was in need of help, and he admitted and understood that. We did have a total of 2 meetings with Dr. Tansey. The first meeting we attended together as a family. As stated, it was on the date that it was stated in the report, the summary that you gave. But even during that first meeting, Dr. Tansey made an inappropriate comment suggesting that our son tase his older brother, as in use a taser on him, as a coping mechanism in response to dealing with the sibling teasing that was going on at home. Seeing our being visibly uncomfortable with the comment, Dr. Tansey then pretended it was a joke and recanted the statement. We want the board to understand that our son is being seen because he is struggling with positive coping skills related to his anxiety and other issues he has going on. And Dr. Tansey's suggestion was not a positive coping skill, joke or not. After discussing the comments at home, and despite feeling uncomfortable, we decided to give Dr. Tansey another opportunity, as we know that he has a very accredited background. In the second meeting, his first meeting of the day on October 15th, an 8 a.m. meeting. Dr. Tansey met us in the waiting area, and he explained to us prior that his customary practice is to meet with the child or the patient first and then bring us in afterwards for any follow-up or questions, which is how things went. So we met us in the waiting area. He took our son back to his office privately to meet with him for about 45 minutes, and afterwards brought us in for a wrap-up. At no time does Dr. Tansey mention anything inappropriate has taken place or that he has any concerns about anything inappropriate taking place. After the meeting, as I mentioned, we're driving home and asked our son how he felt the session went. He replied that it was awkward. We asked why it was awkward, and he proceeds to tell us about viewing the pornography on the computer screen of the doctor. We asked him what he meant by pornography, just to make sure that he understood what he was seeing, and then he described seeing a naked woman on the screen, touching herself, touching her breasts. Obviously, we're in shock when this event happens. We're trying to figure out what to do or how to even respond. We never experienced anything like this. So gave Dr. Tansey a call, got his voicemail, left a message for callback. He did call back promptly. We understood that he had another meeting after ours, so he couldn't call back till afterwards. So he called back after that meeting. And he did confirm, he was upfront, he did confirm that there was porn on his computer and that he believed that he was able to shut it down before our son saw it. So all of that we believe is true. We did at that time advise Dr. Tansey that we would not be returning and canceled all future appointments with him. We filed a complaint with the board, as you have received. I want to state that I'm an adult male, and I'm not the most computer savvy person in the world, but I understand that pornography does not magically appear on your computer screen, of your workplace device in particular. At some point, whether it was that morning or another time, Dr. Tansey was utilizing his workplace computer to view pornographic material. That is a fact. And I don't think that there's any reasonable cause that anybody could tell me to dispute that. So not only were his actions unprofessional, harmful, and inappropriate to expose a minor, but delayed my son, in addition, delayed my son getting the mental health care he needed, as it took us an additional 2 weeks to get him in to see another psychologist. In our view, why I refer to that as intentional is not because he did it on purpose, but because it was his intention to view pornographic material on his workplace computer, which led to this occurring. That, to me, indicates intent, perhaps in the legal form. That's my understanding of intention, and that understanding. I'll wrap up things here. So in our view, this is no different than exposing a child in an elementary school or any other workplace setting to pornography. If this happened at a school or, again, any other workplace, he would be fired and face potentially legal consequences. At minimum, his license would be at risk. So we ask the board to take that into consideration in your findings today. As parents of a child in need, we cannot comprehend Dr. Tansey's need to view pornography in his workplace where he meets with vulnerable children seeking his counsel. We feel if he cannot control these impulses, then he should no longer be allowed to work with children. And we thank you for allowing us to have this opportunity to express our views at this time.
Thank you. I know this is very difficult for you to express what you just had to express, and I appreciate you coming forward.
Thank you.
I know it's very difficult. Thank you. Dr. Flowers, do you have any questions? DR?
No, not at this time, but thank you for your appearance.
Yes, thank you. Okay, step back, please. Dr. Tansey. Dr. Coleman.
Chairperson Donaldson, Dr. Flowers, my name is Larry Cohen. I represent Dr. Tansey, who's seated to my left and is prepared to answer questions. I'm just going to go right to the central issue that was raised by Father. Dr. Tansey was not looking at pornography on his office computer. This image appeared unexpectedly, unknowingly, and unsolicited. And as soon as Dr. Flowers saw it, he removed it. He had no idea it was there. He had no idea it was coming there. He was not looking at pornography on his office computer screen. And I'll get into the steps he's taking to keep something like this from happening again. But it was completely to his surprise that it was there. And I appreciate that the complainant has come here and offered his views. But Dr. Tansey has research the issue, and unfortunately in our technologically advanced culture there's a dark side to that, and which is that people send out messages that have things in them, and sometimes things show up on screens that shouldn't. It's not uncommon, it happens with some regularity. It may not always be pornography, but it may be something else. But as soon as Dr. Tansey saw this, he took every step he could to eliminate it. And that's what happened, and that's why as soon as it was inquired, he didn't try to hide it. He said, yes, I saw it there, but I didn't think your son saw it, and he removed it. Dr. Tansey can go into detail about that aspect of it, but let me cover, you know, this sort of the context in which this all happened and walk through it. You can ask Dr. Tansey for more detail. Dr. Tansey had been working, and when he left his office, his computer screen was in a state that he had left it with. I think the main screen with the was showing, or it may have been the email was still open, but in any event, he went out to get his client. He brought his client back in. He walked in the door. The client came in first and veered off, or started to go to the left. The desk is to the right. Dr. Tansey looked over to his desk and saw the monitor. As soon as he saw it, he walked to the monitor and hit the escape key so that the image would be gone. The screen would return to the base screen. He looked over to see if there was any sign at all that the client had seen the screen. He saw no such sign. When he sat down to start talking with the client, he waited to see if the client made any indication at all. At that point, he had two choices. One choice was if the client had said something, then he would have dealt with it by calling in the parents and explaining what had happened and dealing with it. But if the client had not seen it, his problem was that he was now raising an issue and injecting something new into the therapy that hadn't been there before. And so his feeling was that the best thing to do at the time was to simply proceed on with the session and continue in the belief, based upon not seeing any sign and not having the client say anything, that the client had not seen the screen. He would have addressed it with the parents if he'd had any indication the client had, but he did not. When the father called and left a message, he called back promptly. When the father brought it up as an issue, he said it had happened. He said he didn't know how it got there, and as the complainant has acknowledged. He then had further sessions later in the morning. He went looking to see if he could find this image anywhere or figure out how it got there. He could not find it anywhere. He could not determine how it got there. There was no sign of anything that allowed it to be on the screen. In the time that's followed, he's become more sensitive to the fact that this kind of thing can occur. So he's taken the actions that we've described in our response. He's repositioned the monitor so the clean screen can't be seen by clients coming into or sitting in his office. He purchased a privacy screen to put over the monitor so it couldn't be seen. He locks the monitor screen in the home position or base position by a keystroke combination, and he's purchased software to prevent malware coming in. He had sort of a basic package, but he's now purchased an advanced package to keep anything like this from happening in the future. He's taken classes to try to be more sensitive in his own life and his own practice to how technology can create problems, whether it's like this or something else. And he's doing everything he can to not let anything like this happen again. As indicated, Dr. Tansey has a very long career as a practitioner and as a member of our profession, or a member of the psychology profession. He takes his work seriously. He takes safety seriously. He takes ethics seriously. I respect that complainant has come up with an explanation which is very negative, but that's not what happened here. This was an unexpected, uninvited event that Dr. Tansey took immediate action to deal with, and has taken preventative action so that it will never happen again. And accordingly, we feel that while the complainant's concerns in the abstract and based upon his conception of what might be going on are concerning, that's just not the case that took place here. And with that, Dr. Tansey is available for questions. Thank you, Mr. Chairman Donaldson, Dr. Flowers.
Dr. Tansey, do you have any comments?
I may have others. The overarching comment that I have is how much I appreciate the complainants as parents. I don't appreciate that they raised a complaint, of course, but I do appreciate that they took action on the behalf of their perception of what happened in this case. As a parent of two children, a complaint makes one reflect on themselves, of course, and I do respect them, and I am sincere in my appreciation for that, and very contrite over what happened. It took me by great surprise that it happened. I was shocked, and responded, I believe, very appropriately. I couldn't unring the bell that had rung. I did not, as was stated earlier, I did not know that he saw that. I took efforts to, I believe, to prevent that, and my assessment of his behavior was I did not see any reaction from him. So it was my deep hope that I had not exposed him to that. My computer monitor had not exposed him. I too was taken aback by it, and I don't know that that's appreciated, that it was disturbing to me, and it made me feel vulnerable as well. But I do respect that. I enjoyed working with ZR. I think his parents know that, and I enjoyed working with his parents, and I do appreciate and hold no malice toward them for filing a complaint.
Okay, thank you. Dr. Flowers, you have any questions of Dr. Tansey?
No, not at this time.
I have no questions. The committee will now begin deliberations. Please note that deliberation is a time for committee members to deliberate the case among themselves without interruptions from complainants, licensees, or attorneys representing licensees. Dr. Flowers.
Yes, this is kind of I'll start with kind of a minor point. I think there was the attorney made a misstatement early when he started. He said when Dr. Flowers saw it on the screen.
I'm so sorry.
You know, so if our staff could just make sure that that's corrected in the minutes, that would be appreciated. Certainly, I can see where a client would be very concerned about what he saw on the screen. That, of course, should not be, it shouldn't happen. It does, there are times when professionals get taken aback by what is on a screen or in an office when somebody comes in, and certainly there should be precautions in place, you know, before the person comes in. So that indeed was an error that the licensee did acknowledge, and has, it sounds as if he's made some good corrections to his practice in regards to ensuring that that type of situation is not going to be possible going down the road. And certainly if clients are dissatisfied with services for any reason, they have the option of discontinuing services, and apparently that is what's happened. Those are my main concerns, and I guess there may be obvious statements at this point.
Mr. Chairman, would you like to comment further?
Yes. I understand DR's concern. And I'm reflecting on my experience as being on the school board and on being an elected official. I remember teachers getting dismissed because they had porn pop up on their screens. And the IT people immediately seized the computer, and they found that there was a reason for that pop-up, because the teacher was using school property to view pornography. I remember attending, when I was mayor, attending a conference in Washington, D.C., as a matter of fact, and there was a gentleman giving us a presentation. I remember what it was on, and as rolling along, he was doing it from his computer, pornography popped up. And his computer, after this session, was immediately seized by the IT people, and he found that he was viewing pornography on government property, and he was immediately terminated. So, I don't know where to go with this. Pop-ups don't just happen. There's, from what I've seen, in public life and in well, public life is where I've seen it. And it concerns me that there's probably more to this story than is possibly more to this story beyond what I feel comfortable making a decision to dismiss. I think that perhaps there's people on our full board that are more knowledgeable in this than I am. This case, I wish that Dr. Brundage had been able to participate, because she, because her trainings can deal with somewhat of this stuff. What do you think, Dr. Flowers? I don't know.
Well, there are many concerns. You know, one of the, in a way, positive things is it wasn't a government computer.
Yeah.
Otherwise, it would have been seized, and, you know, but I guess there's a private practice issue. I think it may not be a good idea, but I suppose if it's his, he can have anything on it he wants. But the key thing would be when you're providing professional services to make sure they're indeed professional. I don't feel comfortable dismissing the complaint at this level due to, you know, the allegation. I don't know to what level, you know, we need to go. I would, depending on your point of view, Mr. Chairman, let me suggest the following. We could refer to the full board for initial review for possible violations of ARS 32-2061, 15. On professional conduct, it would be providing services that are unnecessary or unsafe, or otherwise engaging in activities as a psychologist that are unprofessional by current standards of practice, and also with a possible indication. Well, it, like his, another comment would be that this may result in a letter of concern for resolution, but that would, of course, need to be the full board's decision. That's the direction I would see going. I don't know. Looking at all the different possible ethical things, I couldn't find anything totally clear. But this one, I think, would be, it could be, we'll move forward on that basis.
Is that a motion, Dr. Flowers?
Yeah, maybe phrase it a different way without all the editorial comments. I'd like to make a motion that this complaint be referred to the full board for initial review for possible violation of ARS 32-2061, 15 on professional conduct, letter zero, providing services that are unnecessary or unsafe or otherwise engaging in activities as a psychologist that are unprofessional by current standards of practice, with the recommendation that the committee consider a letter of concern as a disposition.
Yeah, I would second that. Further discussion? All in favor of the motion say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed by the same sign? Motion carries. So complaint number 1827 is being referred to the full board. Thank you, everyone, for appearing.
Thank you.
Thank you. And this meeting is adjourned.
I make a motion, and it sounds like you concur.
Great.
Thank you.
Have a good day, Dr. Flowers.
Yeah, you too. Have a safe journey back.
Oh, yeah. Thank you.
Thank you. Bye.
Bye.